joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. At UN Climate Talks in Copenhagen today, President Obama urged world leaders to get behind a common purpose. But the president said any deal on limiting greenhouse gases must include transparency. Iran this week tested a missile capable of striking Israel and Eastern Europe. The U.S. House approved a bill to expand sanctions against Iran. And Taliban militants have been blamed for a car bomb near a mosque in northwestern Pakistan earlier today. That blast killed at least 10 people. Joining me for these stories and more in the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Yoki Driessen of the Wall Street Journal, Farah Stockman of the Boston Globe, and Tom Jelton of NPR. You are most definitely invited to join the conversation, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Welcome to the last International Friday News Roundup of the year. Tom Jelton, where do we stand on climate talks in Copenhagen?
Well, Diane, President Obama is in Copenhagen at this minute, trying to negotiate with other world leaders a last-minute agreement. You know, one of the things that's different about this conference from other ones is that on other types of international summits, the agreements have largely been negotiated ahead of time, and the heads of state come in at the last minute and just sign their names to an agreement that's already negotiated. In this case, there are huge issues that have not been negotiated, and it really will, in this case, come down to these final meetings between President Obama and other world leaders to see if there is any kind of agreement beyond a very vague political statement about the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We're not there yet, Diane.
Farah.
Well, the hope was that this conference would produce legally binding emissions reductions. And I think from what we can tell from the drafts that have come out of the text of the agreement, they're going to really postpone that until next year. Another climate conference in Mexico in 2010. So that's pretty disappointing to people. But there have been some successes. China has always balked at the idea of having international people come in and test and measure its reductions. And it looks like in the last 24 hours, China's kind of softened that position. So there's some possibility there. I also think there's a fund that's going to be set up to help developing countries adapt to climate change and maybe give them some incentives. Some people talk about that fund being $30 billion over the next 3 years with a goal of $100 billion by 2010, or I think it's 2020. So, I mean, there's some movement. And Obama's speech this morning was really aimed at saying, look, this agreement's not perfect. Let's sign on. We know that not everybody's going to get what they want. In fact, nobody's going to get what they want. But let's this is a work in progress, and let's sign up anyway and keep building on it.
Yoki Driessen, how important is what happens there in Copenhagen today? How important is it to the whole idea of global warming? There have been so many ads and statements saying this is ridiculous. There is no such thing. And Obama had very high hopes.
He did. I mean, part of what he was doing there was to try to say to the world, again, I'm not George W. Bush. We are no longer rejecting Kyoto. We're no longer, as a country, staying separate from this whole issue. Unfortunately, as you point out correctly, the politics of this have gotten very, very, very bad just in the last couple of weeks. You had the hack that stole climate emails that are easily mined so as to suggest that data has been faked or fabricated or altered to make the case for global warming, for man-made global warming, stronger than it might otherwise be. That's been a huge blow. And you've had this kind of fundamental dispute between developing countries and developed countries. The poorer countries say to the developed ones, you're already rich. Why are you lecturing us? We need to pollute, basically, to become as rich as you are. The richer ones say, effectively, well, we'll try to help you, but no, you can't. And so you have this kind of very modern issue of global warming break down along the lines you would have seen on some issues in the Cold War, where you had the First World, the Second World, the Third World, and they're fighting almost, it's a new issue, but the same divisions as you had decades ago on different ones.
How important is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's announcement about beginning this $100 billion fund?
Well, Diane, it certainly goes some way towards alleviating the anger of, I mean, Yoki's actually, absolutely right. There, this huge gap between the developed world and the developing world, which we've seen on other occasions, but it really has erupted with a ferocity in Copenhagen that I don't think we've seen in a long time. Now, Secretary Clinton's offer does go away in sort of mollifying those countries, but that gap is really there. And, you know, I was listening to your earlier discussion of healthcare, and it sort of is reminiscent of it, because what you have here is a diminishing center. You've got the developing countries that are saying we need much more. We need more development aid. We need more financing to fight global warming. But on the other hand, President Obama has a right wing or a conservative segment that is absolutely opposed to this. Senator Inhofe, arch foe of anything to do with climate change, was in Copenhagen. And to top it off this morning, Diane, the Washington Post published a poll saying that Americans are increasingly unconvinced by climate change arguments and even thinking that science is really divided on this issue, which is just not true.
So what's happened? How has this change occurred in thinking? When Mr. Obama ran for office, climate change was a huge part of what he was talking about, Farah.
Well, I don't think all is lost here. I mean, there was another poll, Gallup poll, that came out saying that 55% of Americans are supporting a climate accord. And if you look at young people, that young people who came out to vote for Obama,
right,
that rises to 66%. And so I think the idea of climate change is still, there's a lot of support for fighting this. And if you look, I think if you look at Obama's speech today and how he's trying to say there is no difference between economic success and saving the environment. That is his main message. Since he took office, he's been talking about that being a false choice and how economic success can really go hand in hand with green economy, green technology. If you look at countries like Denmark, which tried very hard in the early 90s to have a green economy, they had taxes. A gallon of gas in Denmark is now $8, and 30% of the electricity that they use is renewable energy. And Denmark's in one of the strongest financial positions in the EU right now. So I think we need to hear more arguments about how economic success can go hand in hand with this vision of a greener world.
Farah Stockman, she's foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. Tom Gelton is with National Public Radio. Yoki Driessen of the Wall Street Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. There's been a lot of talk about this latest missile that Iran has apparently test-fired. Yoki, tell us about that.
The concern has been about the distance it can fly. I mean, this one flew longer than most Iranian test fires had before. Israel has for a long time been within Iranian missile range, but this brings much more of Europe theoretically within the missile range that Iran can hit. The interesting part about all this, of course, is, again, with the politics. I mean, the Obama administration has reached out in ways big and small to Iran since it took office. It's sent Nowruz greetings, it's released messages in Farsi, it's referred to Iran by its formal Islamic Republic of Iran name as opposed to just Iran the way that previous administrations had done. And it's been, the overtures have been rejected. You've had American hikers who were arrested in what was clearly an accident who are now being held in the somewhat notorious Evin prison and facing espionage charges. So it's part of a pattern that the administration had hoped would be very, very different.
So what does Iran gain by firing this test missile, Tom?
Well, Diane, we've seen test firings of more or less of this kind before, but I think what's new in this situation is the timing and the context of it. And the context is that because of the evident failure of the international community to reach an agreement with Iran over the disposal of its uranium, enriched uranium, there have been increased threats from Israel that it will take preemptory action against Iran. And so this test firing by Iran comes in that context, and it can be seen as a message. As Yoki said, it's clearly a missile that can hit Israel. So it can be seen as a message to Israel that we are prepared for anything you do against us.
Farah.
It could also be a message for domestic consumption. They showed this on state television, and it's happening right now at a time of political turmoil in Iran where the government wants to say, hey, we're strong. We're not backing down. And I think that that could be seen as a message to protesters, too, as well as a message for the outside world.
So what about this note letter that Deputy Secretary of State Jim Steinberg wrote to Foreign Relations Chair John Kerry, urging the Senate to hold off on further sanctions? Yoki.
I think that's a reflection of the feeling within the administration of just how sensitive a moment this is, that you have an increasingly frightened Israel that as Thomas pointed out, is talking about military action, and the administration thinking time is running out for anything else.
Yoki Driesen. He's military correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. When we come back, we'll talk about North Korea, Pakistan, and other hotspots around the world. Stay with us. Welcome back. Here in the studio, Tom Jelton of NPR, Farah Stockman of the Boston Globe, Yoki Driesen of the Wall Street Journal. We're focusing on the international hour of our Friday news roundup. Here's an email from John who says, I cannot understand everyone's level of anxiety with Iran's missile tests or even their nuclear program. Let's get real. Israel has hundreds of nuclear devices ready to go and the means to deploy them. Iran has none, only the possibility of one, two, or a few in the future. Israel could annihilate Iran, and if not, the U.S. would if they were to attack. Farah.
Well, this has always been a really tough question for U.S. Officials because they can't acknowledge Israel's nuclear program. But in fact, it plays such a role in the region, and Iran points to it as justification for its own need to develop. Well, they don't acknowledge they're developing nuclear weapons, but their own need to protect themselves. And as far as the missile test, I mean, they did test a very similar missile in May. So it's not as though the missile test is new. But clearly, if Iran was to develop nuclear weapons, it would change the whole balance of power in the region. It would set up an arms race. That's the argument that then Saudi Arabia, Egypt, you'd have a lot of countries wanting to go out there and get nuclear weapons. And you're really looking at the whole collapse of the non-proliferation regime.
Yoki.
I mean, there are two points. One, of course, is that the rhetoric that comes out of Israel is not about annihilating its neighbors. The rhetoric that comes out of Iran is about annihilating Israel. So it is true that Israel has more nuclear weapons, but there is a difference when the state that has them acts and talks the way that Iran does, or the way that it acts and talks the way Israel does. The other is that it was set up as sort of a black or white choice, that one choice is neither one has nukes, one choice is one has and could nuke the other. And as Fair pointed out, there's really a lot of gray. I mean, other Sunni Arab states would not rest on their hands if you had Pakistan be a nuclear power and Shiite Persian Iran be a nuclear power. So the UAE, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, you know, as Fair points out correctly, you'd have a regional arm race, which would be very, very scary, since, as we all know, the Middle East is the least stable part of the world.
Tom.
Well, I just would add, Diane, that, you know, if there were a comprehensive peace agreement in the Middle East that really stabilized the relations between these countries, that would be one thing. Then, you know, Iran becoming a nuclear power could be seen as part of the geopolitical stability of the region. But absent a political agreement, when there are so many serious, deep, unresolved conflicts, the emergence of a new nuclear power, and especially an aggressive one like Iran, would be a cause for concern.
Let's shift the discussion to Pakistan, because on Wednesday, you had Pakistan's Supreme Court striking down amnesty for politicians. So where does this leave President Zardari Farah?
Not in a good place. You have this extraordinary. Now, Zardari himself probably has presidential immunity in Pakistan itself. Now, whether or not a court case could go forward in Switzerland, where a Swiss company was, one of the key allegations against Zardari is that he took a kickback from a Swiss company. So it's possible there could be a court case there. But as far as the Pakistani government is concerned, I think you have the extraordinary situation of something like 248 of his political allies who are holding senior posts that are on this list of people who could now be prosecuted for corruption. You have the extraordinary situation of a minister of defense going to the airport to go to, he's about to fly out
and
to China for a state visit, and
he
stopped at the airport because he's told, hey, there are these corruption charges against you and you're not allowed to travel without permission. I mean, I think that it really complicates the situation in Pakistan, and a lot of people I talk to don't believe Zardari's government is going to last very long. A lot of people think that Nawaz Sharif, an opposition leader, has the votes in parliament to take over, but that he doesn't want to because the situation in Pakistan is such a mess.
And we should remind folks that Zardari is the widower of Benazir Bhutto, Tom.
That's right, Diane. You know, it seems to me that Pakistan is increasingly looking like a dysfunctional state. I mean, it is really hard to make sense, rational sense of what's going on there.
And yet we count on Pakistan so much.
Pakistan is so important to U.S. policy in the region, and an indication of that was the aid agreement, the aid package we signed for Pakistan in October, $7.5 billion in aid, and now the Pakistani government is obstructing the United States from actually delivering that aid, with very petty concerns, denying visas to U.S. officials who are there specifically to help distribute that aid. And, you know, this uproar over immunity is distracting the government and its security forces at a time when it has huge security challenges to deal with. Meanwhile, Pakistani people are being hit by bombs every day. And who are they blaming? They're blaming the Americans. They're not even blaming the Taliban inside their own country. So this is a country with a lot of problems.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
In my mind, the biggest news out of Pakistan this week, not as dramatic as a president being put on trial theoretically, but is the flat refusal of Pakistan formally to expand its military operations into Waziristan and other areas where the U.S. believes, and frankly most of its allies also believe, that senior members of Al-Qaeda, remnants of the Afghan Taliban, and the leadership of the Pakistani Taliban are all sheltered. This was formally requested by the administration, and it was even more formally rejected by the Pakistanis. And you have this issue where the Pakistani military fundamentally disagrees with our contention that the biggest risk to them is Islamist. That their military, much of it, believes that even now that India is the biggest threat. And that to us is a fundamental block, because to the U.S., we need that part of the world, that part of the Durand line, to be stable. And the Pakistanis refuse to stabilize it.
Fair enough.
Well, I just wanted to mention, though, that there is a limit to how much Pakistan's military can do. I mean, they will complain a lot and say that the more they do, the more we ask them to do. Mm. They hadn't even gone into Waziristan until after 9/11. It was a big deal for them to enter the tribal areas. We're completely upending their entire system. We're pushing them to have both a civilian government and we're pushing them to go after insurgents who are their former allies. And so how much do we expect them to change overnight? And I just think that we want them to go after our enemies because we are pouring a lot of troops in Afghanistan, and we're going to say it's really going to come to nothing if the insurgents can just run across the border. But Pakistan has its hands full. They have been attacked every day for weeks and weeks and weeks. They've lost something like 2,700 people, civilians, in the last year and a half to these bombings. They have 9/11s every day, and they blame us because they said it wasn't like this before you came. Now, that's not entirely true because the insurgents were there. They were just launching attacks elsewhere. And so this is really a moment of truth for Pakistan. I do think people in the military see that the Islamists are now a threat, but they can't take everything on all at once.
Tom.
Diane, this shows how important it is to link Afghanistan and Pakistan, because I think one of the points that needs to be recalled here is that to an extent, this reluctance to go after the Afghan Taliban in North Waziristan, as Yoki mentioned, is related to the decision by President Obama, the announcement by the Obama administration that the United States in 18 months intends to start drawing down in Afghanistan. So the Pakistanis are looking to that post-American phase where the United States is not a big player in Afghanistan, and a lot of the actions that they are taking now are geared toward that new geopolitical situation in Afghanistan after the Americans are gone. So these problems are linked.
So you've got Admiral Mike Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff there. What did he say to the troops, Tom?
Well, he was in Pakistan, he was in Afghanistan, and most recently he was in Iraq, and he's there to reassure the troops that the United States is not going to be pulling the plug on this operation before they've had a chance to achieve anything. We're on the verge of a major build-up, escalation of the war in Afghanistan. It's very important for him to be there. You know, we don't know what was said privately and what was said publicly. In public, he was very complimentary towards the Pakistanis and saying, as Farah just mentioned, that they're doing some really impressive things in Waziristan right now. Privately, I'm sure the message is a little different.
Didn't he also meet with tribal leaders in Afghanistan, Yoki?
He did. I mean, he does this on pretty much all of his trips to the region, so that in itself was not new. And frankly, nor was the dynamic. You had tribal leaders say, A, give us more money, B, get out of the way and we'll fight al-Qaeda and the Taliban for you. The money part has come and it hasn't really led to much of a change, nor have the previous tribal offers to raise militias contributed much of a change. I mean, the core of the McChrystal strategy as it's emerging is to try to recruit more tribal forces. So it's more amenable on part of the U.S. leadership to that than there was before. On the other hand, Afghanistan is not Iraq. The tribes are not as cohesive. The militias are not as big. So it's far from clear that these offers, even if accepted, even if they materialize, really have that much of a difference.
Yeah.
Well, what struck me is that he walked through Helmand River Valley without a flak jacket and stopped and bought biscuits at a store. And he was kind of showing that, hey, look, when you have 10,000 U.S. Marines, you can bring security to this place. But that also showed that there are 10,000 American Marines there and only something like 2,000 Afghan security forces. And so even if Karzai fulfills his promise to send more, you might have a one-to-one ratio. But that's a far cry from us helping the Afghans, that we're really holding down Helmand.
What about Ambassador Eikenberry saying that there is no deadline for troop withdrawal, Tom?
Well, ever since President Obama made that initial announcement suggesting that there was a deadline, the administration has been walking back that commitment. We've heard it from Ambassador Eikenberry, who was himself reluctant to endorse this buildup in the beginning, so it's significant coming from him. We've heard it most significantly from Defense Secretary Robert Gates. We've heard it from General McChrystal. I think there is a concern, as I mentioned earlier, that if there is a pre-announced withdrawal date of any kind or any suggestion of a deadline, then it will encourage the Taliban, and it will encourage the Afghan government, and it will encourage Afghanistan's neighbors to just sort of look ahead and base their own planning and policies on that assumption that the United States will be gone. That would be a bad development, and I think it's in order to forestall that that you see Ambassador Eikenberry and others now saying that there is no such deadline.
Okay.
I mean, that deadline didn't last a day. I mean, it was clear to anybody watching the speech who follows the military that it was phrased with so many caveats that it was meaningless. It was clear within less than a day of the speech that it was entirely meaningless, and it's become even clearer about how its meaninglessness since. I mean, this date, you may literally see 500 support troops leave some months after July, and that's very, very likely it. I mean, in some ways, the more significant time-related Afghanistan news was Karzai's very honest statement when he was visiting with Defense Secretary Gates in Kabul and took a question about when the Afghan security forces would be ready to secure the country, when Afghanistan as a government could support those forces, and he said 5 years for the army, 20 years till they can be funded.
Yogi Driesen of the Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Yogi, tell us about this software breach involving U.S. drones in Iraq.
Yeah, what it is that the video feeds from the drones that are used, and frankly from other aircraft as well, but particularly the drones, the video feeds are not encrypted, which means that if you're an insurgent nearby and you have a laptop and you have one of the programs you can use is called SkyGrabber, which costs about $26, and you could download it off the web. You could then watch in real time and download and store the feeds of any predator nearby, which is significant for two reasons. One, the U.S. often uses predators over its own forces so that if there's a U.S. operation, they have predators overhead. So somebody who's watching that feed could be able to see our personnel. It's also significant because it shows somebody watching what we're looking for. So predators would be over a given highway. They'd be over a given series of buildings. A lot of them are used along the Iran-Iraq border to try to cut down on weapons smuggling from Iran. And this would show somebody watching those feeds, theoretically, what's being watched, how we're watching it, when we're watching it, etc. What's in some ways more surprising is that this has been known about for so long. It's been talked about in the Pentagon for so long, and no one's done anything about it. This was an issue in Bosnia. We reported today that in 2004 there was a concern about not – in 2004 it wasn't of insurgents intercepting it. It was what if Russia and China basically use a James Cameron-style special effect so that somebody's watching a drone feed, they don't see anything, and suddenly there's a tank. Or they do see something, but it's not actually there. So this has been known about, it's been discussed, but no action's been taken, at least until now.
Well, Diane, this is a really important story, and we should point out that Yoki and his Wall Street Journal colleagues broke this story this week, so, you know, credit where it's due. I think one of the complicating factors here is that ground troops, soldiers and Marines, are increasingly making use of surveillance from drones and other aircraft. Now, a lot of the time, the troops on the ground don't have as high technology available to them, you know, as the drone operators do. So you have a more simplified technology on the ground trying to make use of these feeds, and the feeds are providing extremely important information to them to help chart their ground operations. But the technology sort of has to be, and to oversimplify it, it has to be simplified for the ground troops to be able to make use of it. They may not have the decryption technology that is necessary. So you can't have really highly encrypted signals coming from above if the soldiers and Marines on the ground don't have the technology to decode it. That's one of the issues that complicates the solution of this problem.
So somebody got hold of this. What use was made of the information?
That's the open question. I mean, the way that this was discovered is a sort of interesting cloak and dagger kind of case where U.S. troops arrested a Shiite militant, took his laptop and started going through it, and on the laptop found video files. Then in July arrested other militants elsewhere in Iraq, from a different group, as it turned out, went through their laptops and found an even wider array of drone video files. So it's this kind of interesting sort of spy versus spy as far as discovered. The military continues to insist that no missions were compromised, nobody was hurt. In fairness, that it's a hard thing to prove one way or the other, but that has been the military has been adamant from the beginning till now that, yes, these were intercepted, yes, they could be used, but that they didn't see any evidence so far that they had been used.
How embarrassing is this, Tom?
Well, it is embarrassing, and it's all the more embarrassing because it's coming at a time when this administration is really proposing a much broader use of these drone aircraft, the Predators in particular. I mean, between yesterday and today, there were 10 drone strikes in Pakistan. And I think that's the most in any two-day period in a long, long time. And this fits into the broader counterterrorism strategy that this administration is proposing for Pakistan and Afghanistan. So, you know, to highlight the vulnerability of this approach at the very time when you're really proposing an expansion of this approach, as you say, is embarrassing.
Farah.
Oh, it also just shows that these insurgents are a lot more technologically savvy than anybody ever imagined they would be. And I think that's the new world we're living in.
Farah Stockman, she's foreign affairs reporter for the Boston Globe. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. I'll look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Crazy rhythm, here's the doorway. I'll go my way, you'll go your way. Crazy rhythm, from now on we're through.
Nellie Mackay's latest album is a tribute to Doris Day. On the Next Fresh Air, we feature her studio performance and interview. Join us for the Next Fresh Air.
They say that when a highbrow meets a lowbrow walking along Broadway, soon the highbrow, he has no brow. Ain't it a shame? And you're to blame. What's the use of pro?
Welcome back. It's time to go now to the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Scott in Dallas, Texas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Yeah, I want to say, one, the Saudis already have nukes. That got leaked out by Richard Haass and a few other sources recently. So that race has long begun.
Now, hold on one second there. Yogi, you shook your head.
I mean, unless there's news that the world has missed, I don't believe that to be true. The Saudis are pursuing a civilian nuclear reactor, as is the UAE. But to my knowledge, and I'm nearly 100% sure, if not more than 100% sure, that this is the case.
All right,
no
Scott.
Arab country has nuclear weapons.
Well, let me pick on Yogi again, because you sure were able to parse what Obama's intentions are, but you missed the Iranian thing. And Ahmadinejad never threatened Israel. Juan Cole, who speaks Arabic, has confirmed this. And, Diane, I'd like you to, over the break, do your own research on that. I think you'll never let that again stand unchallenged.
All right. Thanks for your call. Comment, Yogi.
Sure. I'm a little confused by that. I mean, Juan Cole speaks Arabic. Ahmadinejad speaks Farsi. So fluency in one doesn't say anything about fluency in the other. Ahmadinejad has been emphatic about questioning the existence of the Holocaust. He has threatened repeatedly to wipe Israel off the map, to eradicate Israel. So one can debate the politics of Iran one cannot debate the facts of what the president of Iran has said many, many, many times.
All right, to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Hugo. Thanks for joining us.
Jeff, how you doing? I would like to basically make a comment. Developing countries have been raising their voice now about what has happened for the last 30, 40 years. And it's a new generation in South America and Central America where nobody's going to stop talking about green issues. And the big countries don't want to take responsibility. And they don't want to spend any money on this. And they don't want to take any responsibility of what they have done for the last 40 or 60 years.
Farrah Stockman.
Well, I can understand the frustration in that comment. I think in many ways, developing countries are seeing the real effects of climate change as we speak. I was in Kenya in August, and it's not a theoretical concept there. It's real. It's affecting people. People are dying. Their animals are dying. And so I think that he's right that in a lot of corners, developing countries are at the forefront. But I also do think that there's plenty of voices in Europe and in the United States that are willing to put up money. They're willing to put their money where their mouth is to make this happen.
Tom.
Well, I think that the caller is absolutely right. You know, we talked earlier about how divided the American public is about this issue. That's not the case in the developing world. There's no doubt to them
because
that climate change—
Because they're seeing the results.
Exactly. Farah was in Kenya. I was in Colombia last week reporting on the climate change effects in Colombia.
Such as?
Well, in Colombia, you see the glaciers in Colombia are going to disappear within 15 years, according to climate scientists there. You're seeing extreme weather events that is leading to unprecedented flooding that has not been seen in recorded history in Colombia. And people are very scared about what the future holds for them. And as a result, you have demagogues in the third world, people like Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, who was able to go to Copenhagen and make a speech where he linked climate change and fears about global warming to global capitalism. He says there's an imperial dictatorship in the world. This destructive model of capitalism is eradicating life, and he gets a standing ovation for saying that. So this is an issue that is really burning between developing and developed countries.
All right, Farah.
Well, I was just going to say that there is a need for a kind of Marshall Plan to help these developing countries use leapfrog technology. There's a good side to this story. Because they haven't gone far enough down that path, they could change their course of development and use green technology now, but they can't afford it. And so that's what that fund we talked about earlier was all about. There is a desire to have that fund, but we don't know who is going to put money into it.
All right, to Marshall, Michigan. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diana. Great to be on the show. I love your show.
Thanks.
Wanted to ask your guest about the Predator drones and the lack of encryption on the video feeds. I'm hoping the guest can correct my assumptions here if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming since they're considered very cheap pieces of military equipment, relatively, that they're using a lot of off-the-shelf parts. The insurgents are using off-the-shelf radios to pick up these feeds. And so my question is, why can't we use similar encryption we use on our laptops and such, or just basic WPA2 Wi-Fi encryption on these video feeds?
Yeah, okay.
It's a great point. I mean, a reader sent me an email pointing out, humorously, but also as the reader said in the email, with some sadness, all the parts of his daily life that appear to be more encrypted than U.S. Predator drones in a war zone, his bank accounts, his iPhone, his laptop, et cetera, et cetera. The caller is right that these do use, to a degree, some off-the-shelf technology, but it points to a kind of fundamental sort of conceptual thing that Farah alluded to earlier. We tend to think, and the Pentagon has thought this way, less so now, but certainly in the early stages of the war, that the people we're fighting are simple and unsophisticated. And what we're finding is they're able to take cheap technology. To take another example, roadside bombs. We have million-dollar Humvees and million-dollar armored trucks. They're being blown up by $20 of fertilizer turned into explosive and a garage door opener, which is being used as the trigger and as the remote. So you have very sophisticated, very high-tech weapons on our side, $1 million, $2 million apiece, being blown up by $25, $30 plus any off-the-shelf gadget that they can find at home. And you'll continue to see that because they will never have the symmetry of the weapons we have, so they will always be looking for cheap, creative ways of getting around that fact.
Farah, I want to ask you about the letter that President Obama apparently sent to North Korea's Kim Jong-il. Didn't we just learn the contents of that letter?
Yeah, the Korean news agencies have been reporting that Obama offered to open a liaison office in Pyongyang to kind of signal a move towards normalization or better ties. The North Koreans seem to be kind of obsessed with their relationship with the United States, so it's an interesting gesture. If you remember, the Bush administration considered opening a liaison office in Iran but decided against it. And so this is kind of a new attempt to see if they can get North Korea back to the six-party talks by offering them this measure. It may be a way for Kim Jong-il to sort of save face and say, okay, I'll go back to the talks I've been boycotting for a year, and because the Americans have given me this.
What kind of possibilities are there, Tom?
Well, the opening of a liaison office in itself would be a very small move in this direction. And so, you know, that I think that certainly is a possibility. There's no doubt that the United States will want to insist that North Korea, before it moves in this direction, will insist on a North Korean commitment to return to the six-party talks. But there is this dynamic that Farah alluded to that's been going on in dealing with North Korea for a long time, which is that they really want to see this as a bilateral relationship between the United States and North Korea, whereas the United States and other countries really want to see it as a multilateral dynamic, the six-party talks. And so, in a sense, you have to sort of offer North Korea this little bilateral bone in order to get them to be more open to returning to the much larger six-party talks. It's been a difficult negotiation all along. North Korea has been very reluctant to return to those talks. So I think it's an open question whether this will work.
I wonder, too, whether the president's likely to be criticized for offering this in the way of a note to Kim Jong-il.
I think that if he is, it'll be part of the pattern of kind of emerging criticism that the U.S. under President Obama is continually reaching out to adversaries and so far getting very little back. It's possible that North Korea might be a place where there is progress back, since, as Tom pointed out, they have a lot to gain theoretically from better relations, but it's just as possible this will be an Iran dynamic again where we are seen as reaching out and the response back is the back of the hand.
You know, one other factor is that there's a new government in South Korea, a conservative government, that has really cut back on all that very generous food and economic aid that the previous government was giving to North Korea, up to $1 billion a year. And one consequence of that is that North Korea is really suffering right now, in much greater need than it's been in for a long time. It counts on arms sales, and it just had an airplane stopped in Thailand containing as much as $18 million worth of arms allegedly destined for Iran. So North Korea is in a vulnerable position right now.
All right. To Leah, who's in St. John's in the Virgin Islands, where, as we await a snowstorm here in Washington, many of us might like to be. Hi there, Leah.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I'm going to miss you during the break, since you're our connection to the world.
Thanks.
My question is, whatever happened to the case for Osama bin Laden, and why are we not pursuing finding him? Is he still pushing the buttons for the insurgents?
Do we even know the answer to that question, Yogi?
You know, the persistent line has been that he is somewhere in Pakistan, somewhere along the tribal areas that, you know, along the Durand line on the Pakistani side. But that's been said now for several years. The bigger issue is whether, when or if he is eventually found or killed, what impact that will have. There's a belief in terrorism circles within the U.S. and elsewhere that al-Qaeda is now an idea as much as it is an organization. So to the literal question of, is he pushing buttons? No. To the question of, is he still an inspiration? Yes. But if al-Qaeda is a mindset that disaffected Islamic youth all over the world feel some affinity to and can franchise almost on their own, then it becomes a much, much harder thing to try to decapitate, because it's not an issue of killing a person, it's an issue of stopping an idea. And obviously the latter is much harder than the former.
And Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, I think it was last week, said the United States has no idea where Osama bin Laden is and hasn't had any idea for a long time.
And that al-Qaeda is not now spreading its tentacles farther and farther, is it not?
It is, and you're also seeing it as a bottom-up approach, which is in some ways scarier. You know, there had been a belief in the U.S. for years, a sort of pat ourselves on the back belief that American Muslims were richer and less discriminated against and therefore would not radicalize or support radicals the way that European Muslims might have. And what we're seeing now is a belief that that is totally wrong and that Muslims in America, some minority, may radicalize just the way they did in Europe.
All right. To Quincy, Illinois. Good morning, Carol. You're on the air.
Your show, it's a new addition to our public radio station here, and we really thoroughly enjoy it.
I'm just delighted. Thank you so much.
My question is in regards the nuclear proliferation of Iran, if that is, you know, that as a looming threat. What appeal would it have to the more moderate elements of government in Iran, kind of giving them a card that they can play with, if the world truly tried to negotiate with some of the surrounding nuclear powers to look at disarmament like Israel?
Tom.
Well, one of the complicating factors in international politics is the power, the force of nationalism. We see this in Pakistan and we see it in Iran as well. And that means that even where you have a divided body politic, the force of nationalism can sort of rise up and complicate matters. And in Pakistan and in Iran and in Arab countries, the idea that a country should have the right to develop a nuclear military potential is one that resonates even beyond the government. And the unfortunate from the United States and from allied point of view, there actually seems to be broad support in Iran, even including elements of the political opposition. There seems to be broad support for the idea that Iran deserves to have a nuclear capability.
I would say that that's true about a nuclear capability for civilian power, but I'm not sure that's true about nuclear weapons, especially given that the Iranian government itself doesn't acknowledge that it's pursuing nuclear weapons. I think that it's true that when the world looks at Iran and says, we're willing to deal with you fairly, it empowers moderates because they're no longer vulnerable to being called puppets. And I think that that is maybe one success of Obama's outreach to Iran has been perhaps the empowerment of these protesters to be able to go out in these streets and say, we're not American puppets. We're here to talk about an Iran that we want to see in the future. I don't think that would have happened under the Bush administration.
Farrah Stockman of the Boston Globe. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have a message from Kirk in Warrenton, Virginia, who wants to know, Yogi, if there's a possibility the drones were unencrypted on purpose.
It's interesting. I've gotten probably 20 emails over the last 2 days since these stories began to appear, making some variant of that case, effectively arguing that it was a sophisticated psychological deception on the part of the U.S. I don't think that's the case.
Why? I mean, give me the reasoning behind that thought.
The reasoning behind the thought would be that this might be an American way of allowing insurgents to think they have a better understanding of our operations than they actually do as a way of keeping them off balance. The response from within the Pentagon, the fact that Congress will be holding hearings on this, all of that suggests to me that this is, it would be nice to think that it was a sort of sophisticated game on the part of the Pentagon. I don't think it was.
Tom Jelton, for you this year, I'm sure, has been an extraordinarily busy one. Top story for you this year?
I don't think there's any question that the top story this year, for me or for anyone, has been the Afghanistan-Pakistan situation. It has really transformed the Obama administration's presidency. It has loomed over this administration in a way that I don't think President Obama expected it ever would.
Would you agree, Yogi?
I think if we're shunting aside Tiger Woods for the moment, then yes, I would agree.
Ugh. Somebody said to me yesterday, are you going to talk about Tiger Woods? I said, you will not hear his name mentioned on my program.
Sorry.
You just did it, Yogi. How about you, Farrah?
It's true that Afghanistan is occupying an enormous amount of my time. I was there earlier this year, and I'm sure I'll go back very soon. But I also think that Iran is a big deal, and what will happen to its green movement? Is it going to radicalize? Is it going to remain a reform movement or become something different? That's going to be important.
Farrah Stockman of the Boston Globe, Yogi Drizner of the Wall Street Journal, Tom Jilton of National Public Radio. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane, and happy anniversary to you.
Thank you so much. And indeed, tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of the day my husband and I married. So we'll have a very special weekend. I'll be off for the next couple of weeks, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. My colleague from NPR, Michelle Martin, will be in this chair. Then we'll bring you some favorites from the past year. Happy holidays, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.